Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Thursday, April 7th, 2016. Oh, Hillary and Bernie are going at it. They're turning up the heat, and I'm feeling it. I will, however, keep my clothes on, Nelly. The heat has been building for months now, and it was simmering, but things were fairly polite until recently, and now things have boiled over, and I'll stop the heat metaphors. The headline in the Washington Post that offended Bernie Sanders read, quote, "Clinton questions whether Sanders is qualified to be president." And the next day, the Washington Post, having ignited a firestorm, had its fact-checker, Glenn Kessler, write a piece that was headlined, "Sanders' Incorrect Claim That Clinton Called Him Not Qualified for the Presidency." So now we're down to parsing words. And Sanders has used the phrase, quote, unquote, "Hillary Clinton says I am unqualified to be president." And if I were Judge Judy, I would have to rule against Senator Sanders on the narrow question. But just like she boiled over and got pissed and used that line about Sanders' artful smear because he keeps raising the issues of where she gets her campaign cash and how much of it comes from banking interests and Wall Street. A legitimate point, I think, but it certainly offended Hillary Clinton. And she and her surrogates, her message machine, they've been hammering Sanders all along. Mr. Pie in the Sky doesn't know what he's talking about, doesn't do his homework, and so Sanders has had enough. And he didn't take it out on a person in a rope line. He gave a speech in Pennsylvania, in Philadelphia, last night. And so he opened with, "She has been saying lately that she thinks I am, quote unquote, not qualified to be president. Let me just say in response to Secretary Clinton, I don't believe that she is qualified if she is, through her super PAC, taking tens of millions of dollars in special interest funds. I don't think you are qualified if you have voted for the disastrous war in Iraq. I don't think you are qualified if you supported the Panama Free Trade Agreement." Now, we'll come back to that line about the Panama Free Trade Agreement in just a moment. But what Hillary said, and she is clever about this, I give her credit, she said he hadn't done his homework on this friendly interview on Morning Joe on MSDNC. She raised questions about his competence without quite saying that he's not qualified to be president. And so, to an extent, they're talking past each other in this little dust-up. But I think it signals that Bernie Sanders is getting bolder. This is a very risky move to take on a female candidate like this. All of the political advisors, I'm sure, told him, don't do that. But it shows he's really in it to win it. That he is not simply running to make a point to change the agenda or seeking the vice presidency. I think we can pretty absolutely rule that out. But in tying Hillary to the Panama Papers scandal by citing her support for the 2009 Panama Free Trade Agreement, I think Sanders has introduced a new talking point that is very important. And toward the end of the podcast, I'll recap the latest on the Panama Papers scandal. But this fits right in with Bernie's playbook against the Trans-Pacific Partnership, forcing Hillary to change her position to match his during this campaign. Sanders, and we are going to get to the New York Daily News interview here next, but he very clearly says that he would renegotiate NAFTA and the Panama deal and all of the trade deals to improve the posture of the United States. So at the same rally at Temple University last night, Sanders had a bit of a laugh line. He said that Clinton seems to be getting a little bit nervous because of his victory in Wisconsin by 14 points the night before. Sanders said, "We have won 7 out of 8 of the recent primaries and caucuses, and she's been saying lately that she thinks I am, quote-unquote, not qualified to be president." And both campaigns sent out emails to their respective bases using the subject line, "New Low." And that is where the campaigns have arrived at this point. It shows that New York State is now in play. The advantage that Clinton has been narrowed to just 10 polling points, 10 percentage points. And there is a big debate a week from tonight in New York. I think it's going to be fascinating and very interesting. And while the numbers show that absent some miraculous victories between here and California on June 7th, that the Sanders campaign's success will be in denying Clinton the nomination outright. It appears that neither campaign now may be able to get over the threshold, it's 2,300 and some, delegate votes that you need. And that includes the super PACs that the Clinton campaign has bought, and I've got details on that coming up. But I want to cite a really nice analytical piece by Mike Konzol at the blog of the Roosevelt Institute, a progressive think tank. And he read the full transcript of the New York Daily News interview, as I have, and I'm going to share some of the important excerpts from that coming up next here. But Konzol writes, "You wouldn't know from the coverage of the Sanders interview with the New York Daily News. It was called an embarrassing failure. He was described as struggling to explain how he would break up the banks. In the Washington Post, it was called pretty close to a disaster. His answers in Vanity, at the Atlantic, they described his answers on core financial issues as tentative, unprepared, or unaware. And Vanity Fair said that Sanders admits he isn't sure how to break up the big banks." Now, those are bullshit spin lines. And I'm going to demonstrate that in a minute here. But Konzol notes that what Sanders provided was a very credible and lucid narrative about how to break up the banks. He resisted the leading questions from the confused editors of the New York Daily News, and I'll detail that for you in a moment, too. And so the idea that he flunked this interview, that it was a disaster, is pure spin, because the Clinton campaign is sliced and diced, just like, say, the Planned Parenthood videos last summer. And they've brought out these comments, when they're taken out of context, that you can spin up to support this notion that Sanders is not competent, doesn't have a plan, hasn't done his homework. And he gives honest answers, and he gets penalized for that. And in one case, Konzol points out, he's asked a trick question about the recent court decision regarding Metropolitan Life, MetLife. And Konzol points out that this decision has not even been published yet. They're asking Sanders for an opinion on a court judgment that is still under seal. And what Sanders said was that I haven't had a chance to read it yet, and I don't have an answer for you. So in the show file for today's podcast, I have linked for your convenience to the full transcript of the Bernie Sanders meeting with the Daily News editorial board on April Fool's Day. And I'm going to take a few minutes here to share with you what I consider to be the key points from the interview and to demonstrate that if there were confusion, and there is some confusion showing in the transcript, it was injected by the editors. And it's interesting because they are not named individually. Sanders is facing a room full of people. We don't know how many. But there are several voices that are distinct, but they're all just labeled in the transcript as Daily News. So we don't know if it's the top editor or some flunky from the newsroom. The opening questions are about Sanders' main campaign theme, that the greed of Wall Street and corporate America is destroying the fabric of our nation. And the Daily News says, well, what about Apple Computer? It's celebrating its 40th birthday today. Is Apple destroying the fabric of America? Well, Bernie's answer is my answer. No, it's not destroying the fabric, but I do wish they'd manufacture some of their devices here in the United States rather than in China, and I do wish they wouldn't be trying to avoid paying their fair share of taxes. I mean, it's as concise and on target as you can get. Then he's asked about companies that ship jobs overseas. And he says, you know, by the way, I'm not anti-trade. We live in a global economy. We need trade. But the trade policies we have allowed to occur that were written by corporate America have been disastrous for American workers. Lucid, coherent, on message, consistent with his previous statements. All right, Daily News. Now, switching to the financial sector, to Wall Street. You said that within the first 100 days of your administration, you'd be drawing up a too-big-to-fail list. Would you expect that that's essentially the list that already exists under Dodd-Frank, under the Financial Stability Oversight Council? Yes, says Sanders. I mean, these are the largest financial institutions in the world. Daily News. How would you break up J.P. Morgan Chase? Well, he says there are other people who support this notion, and you have two factors. He says, we bailed out Wall Street because the banks are too big to fail, right? Well, it turns out that three of the four largest banks are bigger today than when we bailed them out. That's number one. Number two, if you look at the six largest financial institutions in this country, their assets are somewhere around $10 trillion. That's equivalent to 58% of the GDP. They issue two-thirds of the credit cards in the country and a third of the mortgages. That is a lot of power. So then, here is the sequence where one of the Daily News editors injects confusion. So, Sanders says that, we want to limit their power. Then he's asked, how do you go about it? Well, you have legislation passed, or you give the authority to the Secretary of Treasury to determine under Dodd-Frank that these banks are a danger to the economy over the problem of too big to fail. And here's where the editor says, but do you think that the Federal Reserve, now has that authority? So Sanders didn't bring up the Fed, but the Daily News does several times here. And in this first exchange, he says, well, I don't know if the Fed has it. And that is the excerpt that has been used to hammer Sanders that he hasn't done his homework and he's unprepared. It is bullshit. Just a bullshit allegation. All right, so next, the Daily News. I'm a little bit confused because just a few minutes ago you said the U.S. president would have authority to order. And Sanders interrupts, no, I did not say we would order. I did not say that we would order. The president is not a dictator. Okay, then you'd leave it up to J.P. Morgan Chase or others to figure out how to break it themselves. And Sanders says, you would determine is that if a bank is too big to fail, it is too big to exist. And then you have the Secretary of Treasury and some people who know a lot about this making that determination. The determination is that Goldman Sachs or J.P. Morgan Chase is too big to fail. Yes, they will be broken up. So here comes the MetLife question that I referred to a couple of minutes ago. Okay, you saw, I guess, what happened with Metropolitan Life. There was an attempt to bring them under the financial regulatory scheme, and the court said no. And he says, it's not something that I have studied, honestly, the legal implications of that. So this is a gotcha question, pure and simple. And again, this has been spun as Sanders, unprepared, confused, doesn't know what he's talking about, and we know that that is false. So the exchange continues. Sanders, I would suspect the answer that some would give is that while what they did was horrific and greedy and had a huge impact on our economy, that those activities were not illegal. I disagree, and I think an aggressive attorney general would have found illegal activity. Daily News. So you think that President Obama's Justice Department essentially was either in the tank or not as... Interruption. Sanders. No, I wouldn't say they were in the tank. Now, let me pause for a second because I think that the Obama Justice Department was in the tank for Wall Street. But Sanders is a clever politician who knows that this is not a good line to pursue because the Clinton campaign will then try to separate him from the Obama administration, and he is trying very cleverly to build his revolution without demonizing the failures of the Obama terms. That is a delicate, tight wire to walk, and I think he is succeeding. So, again, his answer. No, I wouldn't say they were in the tank. I'm saying a Sanders administration would have a much more aggressive attorney general looking at all of the legal implications. And I can tell you that if Goldman Sachs pays a settlement fee of $5 billion, that something was wrong there. And if something was wrong, I think there were illegal activities. And the questioning continues, do you believe that, but do you know? And he's asked a particular statute or law that a prosecutor could have or should have invoked to bring indictments. Again, this is a gotcha question. And he says, do I have them in front of me now, legal statutes? No, I don't. But if I would, yeah, that's what I believe, yes. When a company pays a $5 billion fine for doing something that's illegal, yeah, I think we can bring charges against the executives. So next, they say, how are you going to break up these banks? And let's see what comes next here. Sanders is asked about the comments he's made about a rigged economy. And he said, it's, for example, where the wealthiest family in this country, the Walton family of Walmart, pays its workers wages that are so low that the middle class has to pay more in taxes to provide food stamps and Medicaid for Walmart employees. Now, this is kind of irrelevant. But again, I want to show you that the confusion in this interview was injected by the people who work for the Daily News. So a different voice pipes up and says, having lived in Vermont quite along myself and a fellow Vermonter, and they banter a little bit, where'd you live? And then this unnamed Daily News person says, well, when you were mayor of Vermont, and Sanders corrects him, Burlington. The guy says, oh, mayor of Burlington, I'm sorry, I guess you were mayor of Vermont too. When you were mayor of Burlington and you revitalized the city, blah, 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 blah. So again, the Clinton campaign seizes on this false notion that Sanders was unprepared. And in many ways, he was just indulging the idiocy of the people asking the questions without actually calling them out. And so that gets played as being unprepared, being unqualified. Then we get to the issues of Israel and Palestine, and note that the Daily News is owned by a prominent Zionist named Mark Zuckerberg, I think it is, I'm sorry. And they want to trap him on questions related to Israel and Palestine. So Sanders tries very hard to toe a centrist line here. He says, look, I lived in Israel. I have family there. I believe in Israel's right to exist. And he makes all of the, you know, obligatory comments about Israel. But then he says that they have built settlements in illegal territories, and he's pressed on this. He says, I think the expansion was illegal. Moving into territory that was not their territory, I think withdrawal from those territories is appropriate. Daily News, who makes the call about illegality? Sanders, well, I think that's based on previous treaties and ideas. I happen to think that those expansions were illegal. And then he is asked to make decisions on behalf of the government of Israel. He says, how would you expect Israel to be pulling them back? And Sanders says, look, Israel will make their own decisions. They're a government, an independent nation. And later on, he says that let me see when I turn the page here. Oh, okay. He's asked about the attacks on Gaza, the war in the summer of 2014. And he's asked, what should Israel have done instead? Because he described it as a disproportionate attack. And this is where Sanders says, you're asking me now to make not only decisions for the Israeli government, but for the Israeli military, and I don't think I'm qualified to make decisions like that. But I think it's fair to say that the level of attacks against civilian areas were too much. It makes it very difficult, and he goes on there. So he's basically saying that with technology, Israel shouldn't be killing as many civilians when they bomb Gaza. And then he makes a mistake, but let me read this to you the entire comment here, all right? So he's asked if he supports the Palestinian leadership's attempt to use the International Criminal Court to litigate war crimes. He said no. And then he says, look, why don't I support a million things in the world? I'm just telling you that I happen to believe anybody helped me out here because I don't remember the figures. But my recollection is over 10,000 innocent people were killed in Gaza. Does that sound right? Now, the actual figure is 2,300 were killed, but there were 10,000 people wounded. The total casualty count in the summer of 2014 of Gazans was 10,000. So that's the number that he pulled up. But he framed it by saying that, help me out here, I don't remember the figures. And then he ended by saying, does that sound right? So he's being human. And this is considered a vulnerability by the Clinton attackers. I hope you'll read the full interview. And I hope if you operate in social media and you see people posting these twisted, out-of-context comments and the talking point from the Clinton campaign that he's not qualified, that you demand that people go and read the interview for themselves. Because anyone who does cannot be intellectually honest and say that Sanders blew that interview. Kevin Gostola has a good piece at Shadowproof today, exposing the latest tactics of the Clinton campaign. And according to CNN, quote, the Clinton campaign had refrained from going nuclear on Sanders in large part to keep at least some goodwill alive in hopes of unifying the party at the end of the primary fight. No more. A top advisor has said the fight is on. Extending an olive branch to Sanders supporters will come later. So the whiteboard at the Clinton campaign says disparage and defeat and disqualify Bernie Sanders. So there's a really good amount of background here in the Gostola piece, and I hope you'll read it. But it shows that Clinton has used her surrogates and her message machine to put out the criticism of Sanders and to undermine his campaign. And most recently, she has used, in a real gruesome and grisly way, the victims of the Sandy Hook school shooting. And Sanders has a consistent position, and I narrowly support it, you know, on the merits, that you can't penalize a gun manufacturer for legally selling a weapon that is then used in a criminal way. And Hillary doesn't care about the legal issues. She sees votes by pandering to victims and by trying to paint Bernie Sanders as insensitive to the survivors of the Sandy Hook events. And so this is a calculated effort. There is no doubt, and I'll freely admit, that Bernie Sanders has vulnerabilities on gun issues. But what's interesting is that while this is a line of attack in the primary, and while I would like to see him have better positions on gun regulation in this country, I think that it actually helps him in the general election attract more independent voters in states that, you know, are very committed to gun rights. So it's an open question how all this plays out. But it certainly is getting hot in here. And one other issue that separates the candidates that'll be important in the New York voting about 10 days away relates to the Indian Point nuclear power plant outside New York City. And last week it was revealed that 227 bolts that hold the interior of a reactor have degraded or gone missing. And they also reported in February that tritium, a radioactive material, had leaked into groundwater. So Sanders has a very clear position. He says, we cannot sit idly by and hope that the unthinkable will never happen. And he wants to close that power plant. He also says nuclear power is and always has been a dangerous idea because there is no good way to store nuclear waste. Hillary Clinton ignored the safety issues and simply talked about the impact of closing the plant on utility ratepayers. And she snarkily said, I'm glad that he discovered Indian Point. We have to be realistic and say you get 25% of the electricity in the greater New York City area from Indian Point, and I don't want middle-class taxpayers to see a huge rate increase. No, but just put them at risk for a meltdown. That will pay their bills. I'm really impressed with a piece by the actress Margot Kidder that appeared at Counterpunch on April 1st. And a friend on Facebook linked it to me. And it's really interesting because what she shows is the way that the Clinton campaign bought the loyalty of superdelegates in 33 states. And I want you to recall that George Clooney and his wife are hosting a massive fundraiser for the Clinton campaign where a ticket costs over $300,000. And that money flows into the Hillary Victory Fund that I'm about to tell you about. Now, the cost of buying a state's superdelegates comes down to about $64,000 when you break it all down. Last summer, there was a meeting in Minneapolis where 33 Democratic state parties made deals with the Clinton campaign and a joint fundraising entity called the Hillary Victory Fund. And responding to the Supreme Court ruling that knocked down a cap on the aggregate limits that a single rich person could give to a federal campaign in 1 year, allowed the rich people to donate to state-level funds. So, for example, Margot Kidder focuses on Montana. It seems like she lives there. And she notes that when events funnel money into the Hillary Victory Fund, that it gets split up. $2,700, that's the legal maximum, goes to the Clinton campaign. Then the Democratic National Committee gets $33,000. And then the remainder is split up among the signatory states. So, and also this fund is administered by Hillary's top treasurer. Her name is Elizabeth Jones. So the way that Hillary is playing fast and loose with the campaign laws is directly linked to the super PACs that give her the margin of victory, at least on the scoreboard right now. And let me briefly run down this. I'm going to talk really fast, all right? Wisconsin, Democratic Party got $207,000. Oklahoma, $140,000. New Hampshire, $74,000. Pennsylvania, $70,000. Texas, $69,000. Florida, $66,000. Nevada, $66,000. Colorado, $66,000. Utah, $64,000. Alaska, $64,000. Mississippi, Montana, Oregon, South Carolina, Tennessee, Massachusetts, and the Georgia Democratic Committee all got $64,000. So you can see the money behind the network of the Clinton supporters. It's fascinating. I was really shocked to see this piece that was published in a corporate media outlet today, the Boston Globe, an op-ed by Eric Fernstrom, headlined, "Clinton's Missteps Add Up to Trouble." And he writes, "Clinton's skills as a candidate have deteriorated, measured not just by a lengthening string of losses, but by miscues and gaffes. The dashboard warning lights have blinked on. After getting beaten in Wisconsin on Tuesday, Clinton has now lost 7 of the last 8 Democratic contests. She only raised $30 million in March to $44 million for Sanders, third month in a row. And he says that the number of errors committed by Clinton is enough to get her demoted to AAA. And here's one I missed. Last Sunday on Meet the Press, she made a reference to a developing child in the womb as an unborn person. That is right-wing anti-abortion language. And people have tripped her up on it, and it hasn't been as widely displayed or distributed as, of course, the alleged blunders of Bernie Sanders. But this guy Fernstrom says that her blunder was comparable to Trump's statement that women should face some form of punishment for having an abortion. And so this is an interesting piece. It concludes, her inability to unite the party and her missteps suggests more trouble ahead. It's rare to see that. And finally, on the presidential race, I will note that it appears that, I think I said this a little earlier, that the Sanders campaign now sees that its power is in denying Hillary the nomination outright. And so I want people who are in these important battleground primary states not to give up the ghost here, and to recognize that the campaign may go all the way into the convention, and that's where Sanders could secure the nomination. Every day I like to pause and thank the people who support my work with your subscriptions to the Peter B. Collins podcast. Michelle Pasco in Sacramento, Carl Howard in Columbus, Ohio, Janet Price, and I also want to thank Benny Alto in Oregon. They're all monthly subscribers, and you can join them. Come on over to peterbcollins.com. You click on the menu button, then you click on Become a Subscriber, and follow the instructions there. It's very easy. And as you know, for new annual subscribers at the $50 level, with a mailing address in the continental U.S., you have a choice of three bonus books. They're on display on the subscription page at peterbcollins.com. A great article by Charlie Savage in today's New York Times first plays out the comments that are coming from Republicans and then exposes their orchestrated strategy to use fear of Guantanamo prisoners as a campaign ploy this year. You've got Mark Kirk of Illinois, who put forward a bill that would add Iran and Sudan to the list of countries to which the military may not transfer Guantanamo detainees. Now, this is just bogus because that's already the case. Then Kelly Ayotte of New Hampshire Tuesday proposed a bill that would bar the transfer of any more Gitmo detainees until at least October of 2017. That's parallel to the lame duck position that the Senate has on Obama's Supreme Court nominee, as if he is no longer president and we're just going to punt into the next administration. But these aren't the only ones. Ron Johnson, the embattled Republican senator in Wisconsin, he introduced a bill declaring that every remaining prisoner there is one of the worst of the worst, should be locked up forever. And he wants to, he wrote a bill that would force the government to make public 2 weeks before any transfer all of the details. Then we got Pat Toomey over in Pennsylvania, Rob Portman in Ohio. They both have petitions on their websites against Obama's plan to close Guantanamo. And then Savage pulls back the curtain here and identifies how Kirk's bill is completely unnecessary. Ayotte's bill is misguided because it shows that all but seven, well, she claims that, released prisoners have gone back to fight against the United States, which is a fuzzy claim to begin with. But Savage notes that the intelligence data shows that all but seven of the 118 former detainees who allegedly went back to terrorist activity were released by Bush. So this is just another smokescreen by Republicans. Misguided policy being used for political purposes. And finally today on the Panama Papers, we know now that British Prime Minister David Cameron profited from his late father's offshore investment fund, but it was £30,000. That's not a whole lot of money. And when I look so far at the revelations of the Panama Papers, I see an effort to bring down Vladimir Putin with very flimsy evidence so far. And some people have decent explanations. The candyman of Ukraine, Petro Poroshenko, says, look, when I became prime minister or president, I put everything in a blind trust and they parked it in Panama. So I think that some of these issues will evaporate. But there could be criminal behavior beneath all this. And I will note that both The Guardian and an Associated Press story today point out that if you want to hide your money, you don't need to go to Panama, the Cayman Islands, the Isle of Wight, or any of those other offshore havens. You can do it right here in the good old U.S. of A. Because we are number one at providing secret tax haven for tax dodgers. You don't need to go to Panama for that. Thanks for joining me today for News and Comment. You're free to share this podcast with absolutely everyone, and I hope you will. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.